Jameson and Eliza Thomas, both just 17, had been working the late shift in the yogurt shop. Jennifer's 15-year-old sister, Sarah, and 13-year-old Amy Ayers had dropped by to help close the shop for the night.
Four teenage girls were bound, raped, and burned. Jennifer and Sarah Harbison, Eliza Thomas, and Amy Ayers, all killed inside a frozen yogurt shop on Anderson Lane in North Austin. Four men were arrested, two of them were convicted, and years later, their convictions were overturned.
But there's a small group of detectives in Austin tasked with finding any clue that will crack this case wide open for good this time.
As a unit, we all have to remain flexible enough to understand that there is potentially another suspect involved. So part of what we do on a daily basis is to ensure that we, you know, dot all those I's and cross those T's. Since that is out there, I think there's no other way for it to get solved.
Or we could go through everybody we know and keep testing forever, and it may never happen. I don't know.
I can remember their smiles and their and the things that made them who they were. And I can remember it. It's just, it's fading in my old age, you know. The smells and the sound of them being here are fading.
It's a long time, but the pain is still here. You know, if I could just stop missing her, you know, that would be, that's the whole thing, is I still miss her.
Hi, this is True Crime Brewery, and I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
And tonight's episode, Four Dead Girls, The Austin Yogurt Shop Murders. So on December 6th of 1991, Jennifer Harbison and Eliza Thomas, both 17-year-old girls, were cleaning up from their shift at I Can't Believe It's Yogurt in Austin, Texas. Jennifer's sister, 15-year-old Sarah Harbison, was sitting at a table with her 13-year-old friend, Amy Ayers, waiting for a ride home. So firefighters responded to reports of a fire at the shop, which was in a mini strip mall, at around midnight. While they were putting out the flames inside, one of the firemen saw a human foot. He moved through the rubble and the water to investigate, and he discovered three girls near the back door. They were naked and they were stacked on top of one another. They were also covered in styrofoam cups that were soaked with lighter fluid and were set on fire. Now, the girls were dead, lying in a mess of blood, smoke, and debris. All three of the girls had been shot in the head, killed as if by an execution. It was only a few minutes later that the youngest teen, Amy, was found, and Amy was lying alone near the bathrooms. She'd been shot twice in her head. Since the firefighters had worked to put out the fire, the crime scene was absolutely contaminated. A lot of the potential evidence was obliterated and washed away. An investigator with Austin PD's homicide unit arrived at the scene, and so did a local news crew. The footage later played in court showed a chaotic scene of public safety officials tramping in and out of the murder scene. The puddles of water and the displacement of objects, possibly even the bodies, made the collection and the identification of evidence extremely difficult, caused a lot of problems for investigators. So, although prosecutors believe that they know who committed these murders, it's currently under investigation again. The two suspects who were arrested in 1999 and convicted were set free, and the charges were actually dropped in 2009. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with the girls, who they were, what they wanted to do with their lives, go over the night of the crime, go over the suspects, over the years, and discuss where things are now on this episode of True Crime Brewery, Four Dead Girls. So first, let's do a couple of our five-star reviews, and Dick will give us a beer review. So the first five-star review I'm going to read is from Liz in Salt Lake City. And Liz says, like visiting with friends. I feel like I am sitting at the bar with you. I listen at work and find myself answering you or agreeing with you out loud. I enjoy your conversational style. It is very welcoming. So Liz in Salt Lake City, welcome to the brewery.
Thank you, Liz.
And then we've got a funny one here by Josie and Alfalfa. And it's called Guy Totally Overkicks His Coverage. I'm not sure what that means, really.
Well, yeah, it is a football term.
Oh, okay. That explains it.
So you kick off or punt and you outkick your coverage, which allows the receiver to run for a touchdown.
So what does that mean?
It means you made a mistake.
Oh, okay. Well, it says, great podcast starring a wonderful lady and the man who tricked her into marrying him. It's so great that you guys found each other and share each other's interests so fully. You guys are totally adorable. You're pretty much my hashtag relationship goals. So, it's actually very complimentary.
It is, yeah. Even though I would take exception for having tricked you into marrying me.
Oh, yeah, well, that's totally not true, but it's cute.
It is.
So I'll let it go with that, because I thought it was pretty cute.
I like the review.
I do, too. So, Josie and Alfalfa, welcome to the brewery.
Welcome.
So what's the beer tonight, Dick?
We're back in Texas again, aren't we?
Yeah, we spend a lot of time in Texas and Illinois.
So this time, I have a beer from St. Arnold Brewing Company, which is a brewery in Houston.
Okay.
And while I haven't been to St. Arnold, I've been to Houston many times when our daughter lived there.
Yep.
And I've had the opportunity to drink a bunch of St. Arnold beers.
And you like them?
I do, for the most part.
Okay.
This one's very good. This is called Bishop's Barrel 15. So they do these special beers each year, kind of like anniversary beers. So Bishop's Barrel 15 is an English barley wine. Now, we've done barley wines before, and you know that they are very strong, intense beers. Tend to be sweet, fruity, and alcoholic. Although the English version tends to be a little more rounded and balanced. The American version is usually hopped to the max, but the English version is a little more balanced. So this is an English barley wine. And in the ever-present snifter, it's going to be a mahogany color with a thick tan head that receded quickly, and there's a light bit of lace. Pretty. It's got a sweet malt aroma, vanilla, and chocolate. Taste is more baked bread, freshly baked bread.
Mmm, that's always nice.
Vanilla, some chocolate, and some fruit. I think it's more either cherry or plum. I can't tell for sure. This is a big beer. It's like 13% alcohol by volume, but it's incredibly smooth. So let's drink a few. Well, maybe not drink a few because we'd be sitting on our butts. Let's share a bottle.
Okay. That sounds like a great idea. Let's open it up, and I see we have two snifters.
Tonight is the snifter night.
Great. Okay, so let's get started with our discussion down at the quiet end.
Let's head down there. It is really quiet tonight.
It is, but there's that one kind of weird couple on the end. They look like they're either really depressed or really drunk.
I noticed them.
Yeah.
I think they're really drunk.
Okay. Well, let's keep them company, as long as they're not obnoxious.
Yeah, they look okay.
I think we could hang out with them. Okay.
Let's do it.
All right. So first, Dick, I'd like to start out by talking about the girls, because that's what this story is about. It's about four innocent girls who met a horrible death. And I think that in talking about the story, it just wouldn't be right to talk about it without saying a little bit about who they were as human beings.
Absolutely.
Right?
Because they were treated so inhumanely.
Absolutely. I mean, so they need to be humanized as much as possible.
Yes.
Yeah. So the girls were Jennifer Harbison, who was 17, Sarah Harbison, her little sister, who was 15, Eliza Thomas, who was Jennifer's friend, and she was 17, and little Amy Ayers, who was only 13, but was a really good friend with Sarah and the other girls as well. So Jennifer and Sarah Harbison, they were daughters of high school sweethearts, Mike and Barbara Harbison. Their parents divorced when Jennifer was 5 years old and Sarah was 3. And a couple of years later, Barbara remarried a young Italian man named Francis. He went by Skip Ciracci. Now, Skip was strict, while Barbara was the lenient one. But they seemed to work pretty well together as parents. They were able to work that out. And both of the girls were very outdoorsy. And they also liked to sing, and they played musical instruments. Now, Jennifer was tiny. She was 5'2" and about 85 pounds. Her mother said that she was just a ball of energy who lived off of chips and soda. She didn't sleep much because she drank way too much caffeine. And Sarah, she was also 5'2", but she was the more full-figured one at, you know, a huge 110 pounds. She was the bigger one.
She's definitely bigger.
Yes, but still a small girl.
Still a very small woman, yeah.
Now, Sarah was really lovely. She had perfect skin, and she had that big blonde Texas hair. And Sarah was the more conservative of the two girls. She was quieter, but she had this really cool kind of dry, witty sense of humor. And both girls were good students, too. They took honors courses. Sarah was the athletic one, though. She played volleyball and basketball, and she was also a cheerleader her freshman year. And both of the girls loved country music, which is not that unusual in Austin, I would say.
Oh, absolutely.
And including, so this was 91, so Garth Brooks was really big. They sang a lot of his songs. But they also liked some classics like George Strait and Willie Nelson.
The older guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So these girls had taste. I think it means something when younger people can appreciate older music. It just shows a certain maturity and depth to them.
I think so.
Yeah. Now, the sisters were starting to be interested in boys, of course. They're 15 and 17. And especially the ones in the Future Farmers of America.
Yeah, the girls were quite active in the Future Farmers of America.
Yes, that was a big part of their lives.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just the cute guys that drew them to the Future Farmers. Because Jennifer had served as the school's agricultural club president in both her junior and senior years, and both girls had learned to be really responsible, according to their mother, through the agricultural courses. Now, each day before and after school, they went to the FFA farm to care for and feed their animals. And Jennifer also had a boyfriend who was important to her. His name was Sam Buchanan, and he was also a senior where she went to school. Now, Jennifer's best friend was the olive-skinned, dark-haired Eliza Thomas. Eliza was just 1 week younger than Jennifer, and her parents were divorced when she was little as well. Her father was a social worker, and he had remarried Norma Fowler, an associate professor of botany from the University of Texas. And Eliza lived with her dad, her stepmom, and two sisters less than a half mile from the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt shop. Now, Eliza started working in the yogurt shop in late 1990, and she helped Jennifer get her job there. And Jennifer used to tell people that Eliza was the most beautiful girl she knew. She really admired her long brown hair and her brown almond-shaped eyes. She had that more exotic look. But despite her feminine appearance, Eliza was excellent in welding and in small engine repair, which is pretty neat.
It definitely goes against stereotype, doesn't it?
It does. She actually owned a 1971 Karmann Ghia, which I've never heard of.
It's an old Volkswagen.
Oh, okay. And it was always in need of repair. It was a bit of a junker, but she could work on it.
Well, you have to.
Yeah.
Someone has to work
Someone has to, but a lot of girls don't work on their own cars.
Nope, they don't.
So it was pretty neat that she did it on her own. And she was a huge Willie Nelson fan also. And she was a voracious reader. And what she wanted to do when she grew up and went to college, she wanted to be a veterinarian and own a ranch to have her own animals. Now, Sarah Harbison's best friend was the 13-year-old middle schooler, Amy Ayers. She was in the 8th grade. And Amy was the second child of Bob and Pam Ayers. And she also had an older brother named Sean. According to the middle school principal, Amy was the epitome of a good student. She did well in classes, she had lots of friends, and she participated in extracurricular activities, really well-rounded. And just like Sarah, Jennifer, and Eliza, Amy had a passion for animals. Like many young girls, she was passionate about horses, and she actually began showing quarter horses when she was just 3 years old. So her parents had an interest, obviously.
Must have.
She didn't figure that out on her own when she was three.
No.
But not only did Amy's participation in the Future Farmers Association bring her closer to animals, it led her to have the friendship that she enjoyed with Sarah Harbison. And Amy confided to her friends that it was her dream to become a veterinarian and to own a ranch, just like Eliza wanted to. So despite a bit of an age difference, which can mean something when you're that young, they all became really good friends. And they would hang out after school and spend the night at each other's houses, go to FFA farm competitions together, and of course they loved to go shopping and hang out like any other teenagers would.
Mm-hmm.
So it was on December 6th of 1991 that the crime happened. So that day all four of the girls went to school, and when Sarah got home from school, she called Amy and invited her over to spend the night that night. So Jennifer would pick up Amy and take the two girls to the North Cross Mall that night, and the girls would hang out and window shop in the mall while Jennifer and Eliza worked at the yogurt shop. Then, before Jennifer's shift ended, she'd go over and pick the two girls up and bring them back to the shop, and then they could help them close up and they could all go home and have a sleepover. So that was the plan.
That's the plan.
And Eliza and Jennifer really enjoyed working together. When Eliza got to the shop that afternoon, she chatted a little bit with the day shift workers, and then she picked up her register drawer from the office. They started her out with $87.50 in cash and coins, and then she was alone in the shop for 2 hours until Jennifer showed up, a little bit late. And 2 hours later, around 9 or 9:30, Maria Thomas paid the girls a surprise visit in the shop. She stopped by to chat with her daughter, and there were only a few customers in the shop when she came by. So Eliza came out from behind the counter and sat with her mom for a little while and talked. They chatted about Eliza's classes and her job, and about 10 or 15 minutes later, Sarah and Amy showed up, and it was the first time that Maria had met them, so she chatted with them and got to know them a little bit. But as they were chatting, a man entered the shop, and he walked toward the counter, but he didn't step up to the register to place his order. So Eliza looked up at the man, and she recognized him as Daryl Croft. And this was a guy, I guess, who her mom and she had met at HQ Fitness when they went to work out in town. And it was almost 10 p.m. as they chatted with him, and more customers came into the shop. Now Croft walked up to the ordering area, and he stood behind a young guy in an army jacket. The young man turned around, and he asked Croft about his car outside because it had lights on top. And he asked him if that was a police car or if he was a security guard, why he had that car. But Croft was a former military police officer who owned a security company named Longhorn Security. So he said to the guy, "I own a security company." So at that time, according to Croft, Jennifer made eye contact with this young guy and said, "Come on up," motioning toward Eliza so he could go over and place his order with her. But instead, he turned to Croft and said, "You go ahead on." And Croft said, "Well, you go because you were here first." And the young guy said, "You just go ahead." And he was behaving oddly at this point. Croft was thinking, you know, what the hell? So finally the young guy went up, but all he ordered was a drink, and then he went out back to use the restroom. So Croft was kind of suspicious of this guy, so instead of leaving the shop as soon as he got his yogurt order, he chatted with Maria Thomas a little bit, keeping an eye out for the strange guy to come back from out back in the bathroom.
Right.
Because it wasn't really a public bathroom, but the girls would let people use it if they needed to. It was down the hall, a little bit out back. So finally, Croft decided to leave, even though the young man hadn't returned from out back. And Maria Thomas left a few minutes after he did.
So as far as we know, this kid is still in the bathroom or out back someplace.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess they got busy and didn't really think too much about it.
Right.
So a little after 10:15, Eliza's dad, James, and his wife, Norma, visited the girls. And at 10:30 p.m., the girls began to clean up. The last customer was served at 10:45 p.m., and at 11, the girls locked the front door, and they left the key in the lock so they wouldn't lose it, as they always did. And then it was around midnight when firefighters arrived at the shop. It was burning. And that's all we know. We don't know what happened in that gap of time. But while inside fighting the flames, the firemen noticed a human foot in the water and in the rubble, and eventually he found the three girls stacked in a pile, dead, with the lighter fluid soaking the styrofoam cups on top of them. And they'd also been bound and gagged. They'd all three been shot in the head, and little Amy, the fourth victim near the bathroom, was shot twice in the head. So this was a devastating and shocking scene. And the fire and the resulting cleanup had destroyed a lot of the potential forensic evidence at this crime scene, obviously.
Yeah, I guess it was a pretty surreal scene. The description in the book was that the smoke was so thick that the firemen had to be crawling through the water and muck and rubble because they couldn't see an inch in front of them.
Sure. And
they were kind of feeling their way around, trying to see where the fire was. There's a lot of smoke, not much in the way of flames. I think it was actually burning itself out by this time.
Yeah, it seems like there was a lot of smoldering
and then, you know,
going on.
Kind of accidentally find a foot and the other bodies. I mean, holy cow.
Right. That must have freaked them out.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, just horrible. And even to the police, it was pretty shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they're not used to seeing that either. And it was around 3 a.m. when the girls' parents were told about these deaths. For Barbara, Jennifer, and Sarah's mother, the news was doubly horrific. She lost both her daughters in these horrible, senseless, violent crimes. And for all the parents, the loss of their children was their worst nightmare, of course. And they knew that nothing would ever be the same. Their lives were forever changed. And there were these young lives of these four girls with such potential and such joy for life, and it was just over. So just a shock, just a horrible thing that happened. Now, for the lead detective, John Jones, the toughest part was letting the family know, of course. He said that was just the worst thing he's ever had to do in his life. And this is from a guy who's an experienced homicide detective, but these were just above and beyond anything that he had ever seen.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're dead, obviously. They're tied up, bound up, and I think they were arms and or hands and feet were tied with their undergarments.
Yes, their bras and.
And the suspicion, besides noticing or knowing that they were shot in the head, the suspicion looking at the bodies was that they had been raped.
Yes.
Which turned out to be the case.
Right.
Maybe not all of the kids, but a couple of them were anyway.
Right. Well, yeah, they were naked, so it certainly seemed like there was a sexual assault.
It's just horrible.
It is horrible.
So they get busy right away trying to solve the murder. And as you said, it wasn't going to be easy because there was about 700 people traipsing around the yogurt shop.
Right.
And the evidence wasn't going to be the best.
Well, no, I mean, the high-pressure water, the guys going through there, we don't even know if things were where they were. I mean, probably they weren't.
I'm sure.
Everything was displaced.
So they're starting the investigation, and 8 days after the murders, a 16-year-old boy named Maurice Pierce was picked up at North Cross Mall, which is a few blocks from the yogurt shop.
Right. That's where the girls had gone shopping.
Right, the younger girls.
Yep.
And he was carrying a .22 caliber handgun. Maurice was questioned and told police he had lent the gun to a friend, Forrest Wellborn, who had used it to commit the yogurt shop murders. Whoa, we got a break in the case.
Now, do you think he just came out and said that, or do you think, I don't think that he just said that off the top of his head. I think he was interrogated a bit.
We're going to get into that later on. But
sure.
Yeah, he probably falsely confessed to that. Forrest Wellborn denied any involvement in the murders. But he did tell police that he and Maurice Pierce, along with Mike Scott and Robert Springsteen, had taken a joyride to San Antonio in a stolen SUV on the night of the murders.
Yeah, now how far away would San Antonio be, do you know?
From Austin?
Yeah.
I think it's an hour or two.
Oh, that's a bit of a drive, okay.
So they were questioned at length, and then Sergeant John Jones and the homicide team dismissed Maurice and Forrest as suspects. Jones concluded that Maurice had lied and neither of the teenagers had anything to do with the crime. Jones's opinion that Pierce wasn't a viable suspect was partially based on the reputation of Detective Hector Polanco, the interrogator, who apparently had a history of coercing confessions out of innocent suspects.
Okay, so Blanco was the one that interrogated Pierce and Wellborn?
He's the one, at least he did Pierce. I'm not sure if he did Wellborn. But I guess reading the book and watching the TV show, Polanco had a reputation. So they thought maybe that he had coerced the confession from Pierce and that it wasn't going to stand up. So they exonerated him.
Okay.
Pierce, they exonerated, right. Not Polanco.
Well, they just dismissed him as a suspect, right?
At that point.
Yeah. But did they interview the other two guys?
The other two besides Wellborn?
Yeah, Scott and... They interrogated all four of them, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and they were all eliminated.
Now, as I said, Polanco had a reputation. Back in 1988, he obtained a confession from a Christopher Ochoa in a murder that occurred in that year. Ochoa was exonerated in 2002 after the real killer came forward. Polanco is known as a pit bull interrogator who used techniques that were at times successful but were also responsible for several false confessions during the yogurt shop investigation.
Right, so he did more than, he had quite a few people confess to him during this investigation.
He did, and I think Jones said, what, 30-something people confessed?
50 is what I read, yeah.
Yeah. So, in Jones' way of thinking, if Polanco hadn't been able to get a confession from Pierce, he didn't do it. Also, the ballistics didn't match. Pierce's gun was one of close to 75 guns that were test-fired.
That's the .22 that he was carrying.
Right. Police were looking for matches to the .22 and also for a .380 pistol. That was the gun that fired the bullet into Amy Ayers.
So Amy was shot in the head by two different guns.
Right, a .22 and a .38.
Yeah, that's really horrible and strange.
So Robert Springsteen and Mike Scott, the two who went on the joyride with Pierce and Wellborn, were interrogated as well. This was a few days after the murders in 1991, and they were also eliminated as suspects. So either they, well, I guess they didn't confess, or they didn't have enough to formally charge them, but they were let go.
Right. Well, Detective Jones, who was in charge at the time, didn't think that they had done it after he read over their interviews and went over the evidence.
Right. So we're back kind of at square one with no viable leads.
Right. But then in the summer of 1992, the investigation began to focus on three other men, Carlos Saavedra, Alberto Cortez, and Ricardo Hernandez. Now, Saavedra and Cortez were arrested in Mexico in October of 1992, and according to the Mexican police, Saavedra confessed to the November 1991 rape of an Austin woman, as well as to the yogurt shop murders. But according to his confession, Saavedra said that he attempted to rob the yogurt shop, but when one of the women recognized him, he raped and shot them. He also said that he did the crime alone while his friends waited outside in a car. But then Saavedra recanted his confession, saying that he was coerced. So the interrogator, he claimed, poured water mixed with cayenne pepper down his nose until he confessed. Now that was in Mexico, so that wasn't the Austin police.
Right. And he also said that they threatened his wife and family.
Yeah.
If he didn't confess.
Right. So the facts in Saavedra's confession weren't consistent, and it was ruled to be false eventually.
Right.
So of the over 50 people who confessed, there was also Kenneth Allen McDuff, and he was a well-known serial killer. And he also made a confession to the murders, which was dismissed. And he was actually executed in 1998 for different murders. But they don't think that he did it either. So this case remained unsolved until four suspects were arrested, and that wasn't until 1999.
So we're 8 years after the murders.
Yep.
And it's very interesting who these four suspects were, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, Detective Paul Johnson picked up the case in 1996, and he examined the past tips about it. Now, he re-examined Maurice Pierce's interrogation, For an unknown reason, he focused on Pierce as the suspect. Now, he was going on the assumption that the police missed the truth in the files back in 1991. So this whole technique is disputed because according to Joe James Sawyer, and he was Robert Springsteen's defense lawyer, so he is coming from that aspect of things. You have to take right. that into consideration.
He's got his own agenda.
Right. But according to him, that's not the way to approach a cold case. So according to Sawyer, the proper way to approach a cold case is to say, like, what might we have missed? What didn't we see? Instead of being convinced that the first investigators screwed something up.
Yeah, so, I mean, that does seem to me a strange way to approach it.
When, yeah.
If you come out as saying, well, you guys screwed up, so I'm going to figure out why you screwed up or how you screwed up, because I know we got the right people.
Yeah, so that was kind of looked at as tunnel vision or trying to make the evidence fit what you want instead of, you know, taking the evidence where it leads you.
Right.
Right. So, charges against Forrest Wellborn, or Maurice Pierce, were eventually dropped, but Mike Scott and Robert Springsteen, who confessed to the murders after they were interrogated in 1999, they were convicted. But their lawyers argued that the confessions were coerced. So that was a big thing in the trial, that these confessions were coerced. The young men actually recanted their confessions before it went to trial. So I know you did some research. I'm going to have you talk a little bit here about what we know about coercion and false confessions.
Well, I took some of this from Dr. Richard Leo, who's a professor at University of California in Irvine, who was going to testify for the defense but wasn't allowed to, or wasn't allowed to testify as much as the defense wanted him to.
Oh, do we know why?
It was deemed by the judge to be not pertinent to the investigation.
Okay. Okay. That sounds like a reason.
So basically what would have happened was that the defense witness would have ended up being a witness for the prosecution in terms of what he was going to be allowed to testify to.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So anyway, Dr. Leo says there's three types of false confessions. The first one is a voluntary false confession. And this is a fairly typical example. It's where somebody calls the police department after a high-profile crime and says, I did it. You know, there's always people that do that.
Yes, right. We talked about this a little bit with the Etienne Patz case about
right.
how people with schizophrenia and other things might tend to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a compliant false confession. And this is where, after an interrogation, the suspect is worn down and perhaps they're promised some kind of reward or suggested that they will be threatened with something if they don't confess. So they knowingly confess falsely to escape the pressures of the environment, to terminate the interrogation, or to receive whatever reward that's been suggested. Now, these guys, both of them were interrogated at length. I think Scott was interrogated for over 12 hours.
Yeah, I think with those, it can get to the point where they just want to get out of there.
Right. So that's the compliant false confession.
Okay.
And then there's a rare one called a persuaded false confession, which is a pretty counterintuitive thing. This happens when, through the course of the interrogation, the suspect comes to doubt their own memory. So they come to believe or are persuaded that they actually have committed the crime, despite having no memory of doing so.
Really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't think that would exist.
It does.
Huh. And that can happen to someone who's of normal sound mind?
Right.
That's quite a skill to be able to get someone to do that.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Huh. So what do they think these two were if these weren't genuine confessions from Mike Scott and Robert Springsteen? In what category would they have fallen?
Well, they were compliant false confessions because they were interrogated at length. They were threatened with all sorts of things. One of the policemen put a gun to the head of who? Scott or Springsteen?
I think that was Springsteen, but I'm not sure.
You know?
Was one of them.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that was going on during the interrogations.
Yeah, and they did show some footage of these interrogations in the trials, right?
They did.
Yeah.
Selected.
Yeah, that's the thing, is they didn't show the whole thing.
No, and the defense attorneys had a field day with that, you know, trying to get the judge to show or allow them to show the whole thing rather than snippets, because it was prepared by the prosecution. So you know there's some bias there anyway.
Absolutely. But the thing is, with the defense attorneys, they, when they showed the video of the coercion, the defense attorneys were trying to show how, you know, he threatened him, he put the gun to his head, and one of the arguments from the prosecutor was that, well, no, he was holding the gun behind his head, but he actually took his index finger and poked his head with the gun facing the other way.
Yeah, but the guy's not looking at that.
Well, that's my argument, is he doesn't know that.
No.
Right.
He knows there's this guy with a gun behind him.
Right. And then why does the prosecutor get to choose how much of it they're going to show? That's another thing.
I know.
And also, the defense had claimed that a lot of the audio problems were done on purpose to make it hard to understand, because a lot of the audio was really tough to hear what they were saying, I guess.
Yeah, well, it was almost inaudible.
Yeah. So they think they might have done that on purpose. What do you think of that? Think that's possible?
I suppose it's possible, but it seems unlikely.
Yeah.
Because you open yourself up to all sorts of problems.
Well, it didn't seem to be a problem for them in the first trial anyway.
Nope.
No. But you think if you're going to be recording confessions, you're going to try and have a good quality recording of it.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
Well, and they took one of the guys, I think Springsteen, to the yogurt shop.
Oh, I didn't know that.
To videotape things and have him, because he had confessed and they wanted him to show them around and try to make sense of things.
Yeah.
But they didn't record it. I mean, they recorded the pictures, but they didn't record sound.
Well, that's strange.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And they asked, the defense attorney asked the policeman, why didn't they? He said, oh, I just didn't think of it.
Well, that's strange.
Oh,
yeah.
Totally.
And also there was part of the confession where he's asking Springsteen, I think it was Springsteen's, where he's asking him, well, who did what? And he would actually, Springsteen would answer some of the questions by saying, it was Maurice? Like he was trying to say, he was trying to get their approval.
Yeah.
Am I saying the right thing? Am I saying what you want me to say? And, you know, that makes you think it's coerced, of course. That's not great.
Right.
No.
Well, I mean, once the confessions were made, almost immediately, the claim came out that they were coerced.
Yeah. And did they recant them right away?
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
And Scott's wife was incensed at the treatment that her husband had received.
Now, was he the one that they had to pick up in another state? He had moved. There was one that had moved to the Carolinas or something, and they had to move him. And
West Virginia.
Yeah. And the wife said that they mistreated him.
Yeah. Well, that's another guy.
Oh, okay.
That was a witness.
Oh,
named Rose.
I see.
Yeah. They had to extradite either Scott or Springsteen from West Virginia.
Oh, okay.
To stand trial.
Yeah. So now the only things that convicted Springsteen and Scott were their individual confessions. There was no forensic evidence that they were there. Now, in order to corroborate the details of each man's confession, prosecutors sought successfully to enter into evidence portions of the other defendant's confession. So it worked as a trial strategy to get the convictions, but that ultimately led to the convictions being overturned.
Right.
Because by presenting the confessions, the state violated each defendant's right not only not to incriminate himself, but also to cross-examine all the witnesses.
Exactly.
So could you explain that a little bit?
Well, you get to face your accuser, basically. And they weren't allowed to do that.
And their accuser is the other guy who confessed.
The other guy who confessed.
I see. Okay.
And now Springsteen was sentenced to death at his sentencing. And Scott was sentenced to life in prison.
And that's because Springsteen was under 18 when it happened? Was that way? It was something to do with the age. I remember telling you when I read the book that this whole age thing.
Yeah, I know that. But both of them, The death penalty was sought for both of them.
Okay.
And Scott had a nicer jury.
Oh, that's all?
That's all it was.
Okay. Because
the arguments were the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what happened when they were doing the whole thing of deciding if they could be tried as adults? That's what I was thinking was kind of stupid.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they needed to be tried as adults because if they're going to be tried as juveniles, they were both over age 18 when they were charged.
Oh, right. So
and
they couldn't be.
So the way the law works is that adults couldn't be tried as juveniles.
So if they weren't decided to be adults and tried as adults, they wouldn't have been able to prosecute them at all.
Right.
I see.
So conveniently, even though they were juveniles when the crime was committed by them, allegedly.
Yeah.
They were going to be tried as adults.
Okay.
So that they could go to trial.
But one of the other laws in Texas was that you can't get the death penalty if you committed your crime when you're under 18. But I guess if they go ahead and say they're going to try you as an adult, that doesn't matter.
As adults, right.
I don't get it. I mean, that whole law needs to be looked at.
Very convoluted logic, isn't it?
Yeah. Either you're an adult or you're not, and we need to deal with them in an appropriate way.
Right.
And I just find this ridiculous of you get tried as an adult or not. And it seems like they usually do get tried as an adult.
Sure.
Even if they're like 13 or 14 years old.
You're right.
I don't agree with that. It just seems like that needs to be looked at. It's very convoluted, like you said.
Oh, it sure is.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, both of them were convicted, and that brought about automatic appeals.
But they were basically convicted based on the confessions of one another.
Right.
And since Scott couldn't be compelled to testify at Springsteen's trial, then Springsteen could not challenge the substance of Scott's confession after it was entered into evidence. So this was the whole basis of the appeal, or at least part of it.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Well, and it's a big basis.
Sure.
Because both appeals were granted.
But I wonder why the prosecutor wouldn't have known that. They've gone to law school. They've practiced. They should know how this works.
Yeah, well, there was a case in Washington State with a similar thing.
Yeah.
And it had been initially ruled in favor of the prosecution. Then it was appealed, and it was taken away. Then it was appealed again or tried again and found guilty again. And it ended up going to the Supreme Court. And they said, basically, that you have to be able to face your accuser. So that's what the defense teams were using for legal precedent. And it was fairly recent before these guys. So it worked.
Yeah.
And I can certainly see that. I mean, you got a guy who's, yes, he's confessed to the murders, but he's also implicated you in the murders. You should be able to question him.
Well, yeah, that's your right.
Right.
But after the convictions of Scott and Springsteen were vacated, the prosecutors vowed that they would be retried, so they still thought that they did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I shouldn't laugh, but this is where it gets interesting.
Yeah. So defense lawyers looked at the statements of different witnesses to create a larger picture of the night of the murders, and they put the information from statements into a timeline, denoting who remembered seeing whom at the store at what time, and this gave them kind of a clearer sequence of events that night. And defense lawyers felt that this revealed the real killers, which they said were two men who were in the yogurt shop sitting at a booth as the girls cleaned up the shop. Now, according to police statements, there was a married couple, and they saw two men sitting at a booth and acting strangely. And the woman said that the two men made her uncomfortable. But the couple left the shop as the girls began to close up, and they left the two men alone with them. So if this is true, this kind of tells us that you need to trust your gut. If you've got this creepy feeling about two guys, are you going to leave them with four girls in the shop?
And was this known way back when they were first investigating?
Yeah, it was in the timeline, but the defense put this stuff together, and that's who they thought the...
Why didn't someone look into that?
Well, they may have. I don't know.
Yeah.
But this was the defense attorneys all got together, and they thought that these were the likely killers.
Okay.
Now, considered in this sequence of recollections of at least one other witness, who was that Durrell Croft, the guy who had the security truck?
Yeah, who saw the kid go into the bathroom.
Right. When he visited the shop around 10 p.m. to buy yogurt for himself and two friends, he was approached by the young man. He said the young man was wearing a military fatigue-style jacket, and he was loitering in the customer line, and he'd had other customers go ahead of him, a couple of different customers. But when Croft came in, the young man offered to allow Croft to go ahead of him. And when Croft refused, the young man approached the counter, and that's when he only got a soda, and he went to the back to use the restroom. So Croft testified that the man never returned before he left, and Croft described this person as someone around 20, 6 feet tall, dark hair, clean shaven. But when he did, they did have him go to lineups to identify suspects, and it included the four arrested men in the lineups at some point. He wasn't able to identify this guy. So this could have been one of the guys that was sitting at the table that the married couple saw.
I guess it could have been, because it sounds like time-wise it's close enough.
Yeah, and the idea might be that they left the back door propped open, that he went out the back, propped the door. And that's how they got in.
And that's how they entered, because the front door was locked.
Yeah, the front door got locked at 11.
Yep.
So, although the lawyers admit that eyewitness identifications are notoriously unreliable, do you want to say anything about that? Because I know that's a topic you like to talk about.
No, I've spoken enough about that.
Well, mistaken IDs are responsible for the majority of Texas exonerations, according to the book.
Right.
And this book was Murdered Innocence that I'm talking about that we read.
Yeah. You know that eyewitness accounts are a lot of times unreliable.
Yeah. Because there's so much that goes into your thinking.
Right.
Yeah. And when you see someone, it can be very suggestive.
It can be.
Yeah.
Plus, you might have some suggestions put your way by the officers who are questioning you.
Yep. Yep. But the attorneys do believe that the accounts of the final customers, that married couple, along with some other crime scene evidence that we're not privy to, offer a more accurate picture of what happened in the shop just before closing that night. So anyway, when the charges against Springsteen and Scott were initially dismissed, prosecutors and police were adamant that the two were guilty, and they remained their prime suspects despite what anybody said. Despite the fact that there wasn't really any evidence, they just really thought it was them.
Right. Yeah. Well, you mentioned the tunnel vision. That's an example.
Right.
Because they had, as you said, absolutely no forensic evidence. The only thing they had was their confessions.
Yeah, and the 22 didn't match.
Right.
Right.
And they never found the 38 gun to compare.
Because they actually dragged the lake, was it Austin Lake?
Yeah, supposedly one of the four said that they had thrown the gun into Lake Austin. And they searched it, but that's like looking for a needle in a haystack. So they never found a gun. So they had no gun to compare ballistics with. They did have the .22 that was Maurice Pierce's, but it didn't match. So it wasn't used in the murders.
And I'm not saying they're innocent, but that would seem to eliminate them. If the gun he's saying did it isn't the gun that did it,
right?
Then it kind of, that's pretty sticky as far as convicting him.
It's a tough way to get a conviction,
yeah,
for sure.
So in an attempt to strengthen their case against the two men, they had further advanced DNA testing that they did. And there was male DNA taken from a vaginal swab of 13-year-old Amy, and it turned out not to belong to any of the four suspects, Scott, Springsteen, Pierce, or Wellborn.
Oops.
So, yeah, so they're looking for evidence to help their case, and they find something that really just kind of blows their case apart.
It kind of, if not exonerates the four, but it certainly isn't any of their DNA. So they got this unknown subject.
Yeah, an unknown male.
And they're going around testing all sorts of men.
Mm-hmm.
First responders.
Sure. Well, the prosecutor insisted that this did not exonerate the men because the DNA they said could have come from someone unrelated to the crime before it was committed. But I don't really see that.
I know how they can say that, but geez, it came from her vagina.
Yeah, this is a 13-year-old girl. This isn't a sexually active woman.
Right.
Right? Yeah, but the DNA did not match any in the police database or any of the 100-plus men that they tested in the city of Austin. Like you said, they looked at whether the unknown DNA could be a result of contamination, and they also tested safety employees, emergency responders that were at the scene, as well as the lab workers who conducted the tests to see if it was contaminated.
And no matches.
No matches. Mm-mm. So Springsteen and Scott, they were convicted in 2001 and 2002, and then they were released on June 24th, 2009. And Rosemary Lemberg, the Travis County District Attorney, moved to dismiss all the charges against them on October 28th, 2009. And she wasn't really happy about doing that. And of course, the girls' families weren't happy about it either.
No, I mean, the families have come to believe that they have the killers.
Yes.
And now you're letting them go.
Right.
You're dropping the charges.
Yeah. You know, that has to be traumatic.
What a crushing blow.
Sure. Yeah.
But at the same time, there's absolutely no case against him.
Right. Yeah, so she had to dismiss all the charges because the DNA couldn't be identified and the convictions couldn't be pursued without finding out where that DNA came from. You know, and they didn't have any other forensic evidence to counteract it. It's not like some of the suspects' DNA was there and this one. This was the only DNA there.
This is the only male DNA that they found.
So some in the prosecutor's office tried to put forth the idea that maybe there was a fifth one with them, a fifth guy with them. And that's where the DNA came from. So they were still guilty, but there was a fifth unidentified person, too.
Well, that's a stretch, isn't it?
I thought so, yeah.
I mean, nobody's ever said...
They never mentioned anyone
else.
There
was a fifth guy.
Right.
I mean, it was these four guys. They didn't say we had another guy with us, even when they were busy confessing. And from what they said, when they did the confessions, and granted they weren't true confessions, but
not that we know of.
Right.
Right.
More than one guy raped the girls.
Yes. So if these girls were raped, why isn't there any of these four guys' DNA? That's another thing.
Exactly.
Very strange.
Just this unknown DNA.
Right.
So I have a tough time thinking that there was a fifth person involved.
Yeah. So something interesting happened in December 2010. The Austin police conducted a traffic stop on a vehicle that was driven by Maurice Pierce. And after pursuing Pierce on foot, Pierce struggled with one of the policemen, and he ended up removing a knife from his belt and stabbing the policeman in the neck.
So, jeez.
Yeah. So the policeman pulled out his gun and shot Pierce to death, and that's how Maurice Pierce died.
Wow.
Yeah, but there was this really interesting article. It was written in 2011. And in this article, Pierce's adult daughter, Marissa, said that her father was forever haunted by his name being linked to the yogurt shop murders. And she thinks that it really did some serious damage to his life and his outlook on the world.
I could see that.
Mm-hmm. So the Pierce family painted a portrait of Maurice being a loving son and sibling and a doting father who had no involvement in the killings. And they told of the struggles he faced. You know, he was just gripped by the belief that police were following him and no one wanted to give him a job. He never had a chance. He just had this whole outlook on the world that changed because of that. Now, we have no way of knowing if he would have been like that anyway or how much of it was caused by this, but it did seem to have a negative impact on the rest of his life.
Well, it certainly wouldn't help.
No. And he had a few run-ins with police over the years, and his family believes that his arrest and the interrogations led him to feel a lot of paranoia and a complete distrust for police and a lot of society as well. So that was an interesting article on how this all affected him. And his family, of course.
Big effect.
Yeah. So after reading the book, and then we watched the 48-hour special, as well as some archived news stories. What's your opinion on this case, on who did it, on what they should do now? Have you got any ideas?
Well, until they somehow find the match to the DNA, I think they're stuck.
And how would they go about finding a match to the DNA?
They're going to be picking up more database DNA.
Yeah, I think that's the only thing they could do is hope that it comes through on the database.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, I'm kind of ambivalent about these four guys. I can see where those probably were false confessions, but I'm not entirely sure that they're blameless.
No, I'm not either. But I do find it strange that if these girls were raped, that there's none of the DNA, although then you have this whole, the water and everything from the fire could have washed whatever DNA there was away, so it's really hard to say if these will ever really be solved.
Oh, I agree. Because this was in 1991, so we're 25 years now.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the convictions were in 2001 and 2002.
Yes.
And then overturned.
In 2009, they were exonerated.
So there's another 6 years.
Yeah.
That I'm sure they've been investigating and trying to figure out, and they haven't been able to, so.
Well, from the interview I saw with Forrest Wellborn, I really didn't think he had anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see anything about him that would make me think he had any part in it.
Well, he was allegedly the driver of the car.
Yeah, but then when they got into the confessions and the story, they were all four in there, right? And they all did the killings.
It's a mixed up confession.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if Wellborn was in the building or not in the building.
Right.
In the confessions.
Right. But from the interview I saw with him, I really didn't think he had anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just didn't seem like it. And another point is that Pierce and Wellborn were out free all these years, and that we know of, there's no sign that they ever raped or robbed anyone.
No.
No. Which is, you know, I think it's kind of strange that in your teens you're going to do something like that and then never again. I think that's unusual. Especially something like rape and that kind of really horrible violence.
Those horrible violent crimes takes basically a sociopath or psychopath to commit them. And they're not going to do it and then lie dormant for years and years.
You wouldn't think so. No. That's another thing that makes me think maybe they didn't do it. Now, the two that were in prison a long time, that's kind of a different story, because they haven't been out and about the whole time. So now it's just all kind of up in the air.
It is. It's going to be a tough case to crack.
Yeah. Now, speaking of up in the air, what's going on with your beer review contest?
Well, for those who might not know, we are doing a contest to win a True Crime Brewery t-shirt.
And a coaster I threw in.
And the coaster you threw in.
Yeah.
And if we keep doing this, you're going to throw in a snifter too. But
possibly.
Anyway, from November 1st to January 1st, I'm inviting beer reviews. I want you to review your favorite beer and send me the review. Stipulation is, and I'm not going to go through being original and only good beer and blah, 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 but the stipulation is it has to be a spoken word review. So I don't want anything typed or written. You can go to tigrabber.com and do the voicemail link. That's the easiest way. Or you can use your computer or smartphone and do an audio file, attach it to the email, and send it to truecrimebrewery@tigrabber.com. So there's a couple ways to get your voice into our clutches so I can hear your reviews. So get them in. I'm looking forward to seeing some more.
How long is this contest going till?
Till January 1st.
Okay. Yeah, so another 6 weeks.
Right.
Okay.
And sometime after the 1st, I'll pick a winner and announce the winner.
Okay.
And read the review.
That'd be cool. I'm looking forward to hearing how other people do reviews. You might learn something to improve on yours, even.
I'm sure I could.
Because
I'm not, I read some reviews of beers and people really know how to write.
Yeah.
And I don't.
You do. You always say that, but you're an excellent writer.
But
You're just very succinct. You're not verbose.
There's some good reviews.
Yeah.
Anyway, send me some audio reviews.
Sounds good. So I just want to take a moment before we end today to share my ideas about independent podcasting. We watch TV, we go to the movies, right? And we listen to the radio. So I'm a significant consumer of these media outlets. And so are you, Dick. You do a fair amount of that. Maybe not as much as I do, but...
Nowhere near as much as you do.
Okay. All right.
Then you're more tech savvy than I am anyway.
Yeah, but that you can still enjoy media.
I can.
Yep. But as you know, and maybe our listeners don't know, near and dear to my heart are the podcasts that are an important part of my day-to-day life. Now, more often than not, I've got a podcast going in my ear with my little Bluetooth thing. I'm walking around, I'm listening, because I love my podcasts. I love to listen to podcasters, and I only listen to independent podcasters. So whether it's a true crime podcast, if it's a historical podcast, or if it's something technical where I'm learning things, and they're run by independent people like us, it's important to listen to and to learn from people, I believe, without corporate influences or ulterior motives. So I like to support my podcasters, and I do it in different ways. I tell family and friends about ones that I like. I try and write reviews for them on iTunes, things like that. There are a couple of my favorites that I subscribe to or send a few bucks to help keep them going and support them. And I especially like to spread the word to family and friends about, hey, have you listened to this one? Stuff like that, to get the word out there, because I feel like if there's a good independent podcast, I want more people to hear it. And they don't have the advantage of, you know, big media, big commercial ventures like that to get out to the public.
Right.
So I think that's my duty as a listener to do that. So with that in mind, I humbly ask that our listeners do something of the same. So if you feel so inclined, I would love if our listeners, any of you who haven't already, would leave a 5-star review for us on iTunes. If you're feeling generous and you can afford it, join Team Tie Grabber. It's just a tiny bit of money, but it helps support us. And also do some shopping through our Amazon affiliate link. That really can help us out a lot, especially with the holidays coming up, people doing a lot of shopping. It's just one extra step, or you can just, instead of going to the Amazon website, go to ours and just click the little blue line where it says shop Amazon and support us. And that doesn't cost you anything.
Not a cent.
Nope, it's totally free to do that and super helpful, very supportive. And it's all very much appreciated. But, you know, most importantly, what I ask of you is to just keep meeting us at the quiet end of the bar. It means a lot to us. This is something we enjoy doing as a couple. It's our hobby. You know, it's something fun that we can do together. I enjoy doing the research and putting it together. Dick, of course, enjoys picking out the beer. I say, hey, we're doing this crime from such and such town, and he goes out and finds a beer for it. So it's a lot of fun for both of us to share that. So I just hope that we'll keep seeing you at the quiet end of the bar, and I hope you'll invite some friends and family to come and join us as well.
That's the main thing, that we're down at the quiet end together.
That's right. So that's all I wanted to say. I just wanted to let people know where I was coming from with this.
I like it.
And that I really do appreciate everyone who listens.
As do I.
Yep. Okay, so that wraps it up. And we'll have another exciting episode of True Crime Brewery for you in a few days.
We will.
A week or so.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, goodbye, everybody. Be nice to each other. Night, folks.